pray. Lord, thank you for the work that you did so many years ago through your servant Zechariah, Lord, to set before the people something to encourage them in their difficult days. Thank you, Lord, we see the future set before us. Lord, there are things he spoke of that are still yet to be. Lord, what we see of what you have fulfilled, Lord, it just encourages us to keep on trusting, Lord. Lord, you're in charge of the world and in charge of history. And we just bless you, Lord, that we worship and serve the living God. Lord, and we ask your blessing and help us by your Spirit as we dig into the Word again. In Jesus' name. Amen. Good. Right. Well, we've got to Zechariah. And it's chapter 9. And we stopped at the end of verse 10. Right. When it describes the reign and rule of Jesus, the Messiah, over the whole world. Remember that? Right, we've got all of that, all over the world. Jesus reigns, it says. His rule will extend from sea to sea, from the river to the ends of the earth. Right. Now, one of the things that prophets are good at is they're good at clicking to the next page. Right. They knew about the internet before it was invented. Right. And the thing about the prophets is they can flick from one time to another. And the very next verse takes us right back to the times and the following times of Zechariah. So, we've got in verse 10, the end of time, Jesus ruling, and then right down on verse 11, as for you, so it's back down to earth, as it were, right? As for you, because of the blood of my covenant with you, I will free your prisoners from the waterless pit. Right, so there you are, there's God's promise. Have you found it yet, Gene?
Yeah,
just... We're working on it.
Yeah,
right.
I'll keep going to the other
one. As for you, we're just going to look at... fulfillment of some of these prophecies, and they do move on towards the end as well, but right, what does he mean by because of the blood of my covenant with you? It means this, basically, that God had made a promise, right? The Israelites had they'd said they would follow the Lord and serve the Lord, fine, but they didn't do it very well. But the Lord said, I'm going to take you and make you into a nation, and you're going to be mine, right? God made a commitment and he's going to keep it. That's the blood of the covenant that he makes, yeah? Right, so, having done that, he says, I'll set your prisoners free from the waterless pit. Right. Can you think of any waterless pits in the Old Testament? There are two.
Joseph
was put into a waterless pit, right? Pretty much rejected and abandoned by his family, right? Pretty rotten place to be. There was someone that was nearer Zechariah's time. It was Jeremiah. When Jeremiah had upset the authorities, they put him down a pit. Fortunately, it was waterless, but it wasn't very nice. So he got a friend to get him out of it. And he was held as a sort of confined to barracks, prison type thing. But a waterless pit is a pretty terrible place to be. And the Lord says he'll rescue them out of it, right? And he's done that for them, hasn't he? God has delivered them out of the dangers of the destruction in Babylon and all of that. And so, God was going to promise to continue doing that, right? And then this lovely comment there, return to your fortress, O prisoners of hope. How about that? He says, come back! Come back to your home. Come back to where there's a place you can trust the Lord in. Have you ever been a prisoner of hope?
Yes.
Yes? It's good, isn't it? Hope has got caught you captive. Right, that's wonderful things to have, yeah? So, come back, even now, I announce that I will restore twice as much to you. What's he saying?
He's
going to bless you. Right? Double dose of good, great, good things, right? That's the best of his making, yeah? It's a wonderful promise, yeah? Isn't that, I don't know if you're aware of it, but Zechariah is full of scriptures, he's quoting back all the time, and there's a promise in Isaiah. This is the double bit, right? Right? It's comfort my people, speak tenderly to Jerusalem. It's Isaiah 40, I think, something. Yeah? I will pay you back double for all your sins. That doesn't mean to say God's going to get even with you twice. Yeah? It means he's going to bless you. Right? He'll pay you back double. He'll give you the blessing in the place of your sins. And that's the promise there. I'll restore to you twice as much now. And then he says this, I will bend Judah as my bow and fill it with Ephraim. Right? What's that all about? I'll bend Judah as my bow and fill it with Ephraim. You military people, you know about this, do you?
Judah
is the south. Ephraim is the northern kingdom. Right? Chapter 9, verse 13. God says, basically, what's he going to do? He's going to get a bow. God's going to get a bow. That's Judah. And what's he going to put in it?
Ephraim.
Right? In other words, Judah and Ephraim are going to be reunited as his people. Right? And he's going to use them as weapon of war. Right? Yeah. This little group of people, these Israelites, God says, I'm going to take on the nations with you. By bow and arrow. That just sounds like a little kid coming to fight Goliath, doesn't it? Fortunately, Goliath didn't realize the little kid could kill him. And he did. And God's going to use Judah and Ephraim as his people. That's the gathered people again. Because they've been split up, remember? Yeah, so God's going to get them back together, and he's going to fight for them, and fight with them. And he's going to use them to fight. He says this, I will rouse your sons, O Zion, against your sons, O Greece, and make you like a warrior's sword. Well, he's changed the weapon from a bow and arrow, now to a sword. And who's he going to fight? Greece. Right, you got that, right? So the sons of Zion are the Israelites, and they're going to take on Greece. Right? How more ridiculous can you get? I mean, this is prophecy, remember? Yeah? Greece isn't even on the scene now. It's the Persians. Right? The next world empire that's coming hasn't arrived. And yet, Zechariah prophesies, Greece is going to come, and I'll shoot it down. Right? Greece is going to go. Ask you one simple question, you historians. Did Greece come? Did Greece go? Yeah. Sure did. Is Israel still alive?
Yeah.
That's strange, eh? Are these prophecies really, really true? Right, so that's that bit. We'll come. A little later on, I've got a PowerPoint to show you of how that victory over Greece was achieved. Yeah? But we'll show that in a little while when we finish the other sections here. Right? So, now then. We have these divisions in my Bible, the Lord will appear. But it's all part of the same thing, right? He says, then the Lord will appear over them, his arrow like flashing light, flash like lightning. The sovereign Lord will sound the trumpet, he will march in the storms of the south, and the Lord Almighty will shield them. They will destroy and overcome sling stones. So, God says, I'm going to get my bow and arrow and my sword, right? So that little division there, the Lord will appear, is really, it spoils the flow. God says, I'm going to get my bow and arrow, we're going to take on Greece, and he said, the Lord will flash over them like lightning. Yeah, in his power. God's going to be over his people to defend and to bless them. God's done that before, hasn't he? He's going to do it again. I don't know if you've heard of, but there are some instances during the Israeli Six-Day War where some of the soldiers testified they saw a hand in the sky turning the missiles around and sending them back. Yeah? God will fight. Father is what he's saying here. So, that's good to have him on your side, isn't it? Right. The sovereign Lord will sound the trumpet. That's the trumpet battle cry, yes? Right. The Lord Almighty will shield them. They will destroy. Who's the they? Israel, his people. They will destroy. And the NIV says, they will destroy and overcome with sling stones. But the wind's not there. Really, yeah? So they're going to overcome sling stones. The weapons of the enemy are sling stones. You know, they got powerful. The Romans invented them. Well, they didn't invent them, they used them. They developed the high caliber sling stones, you know. Serious things they were. Yes, yes. But they got sling stones, sort of hand jobs, I suppose this was. But they're going to overcome them. Right? And he says, they will drink and roar as with wine. They will be full like a bowl used for sprinkling the corners of the altar. Now here's some interesting and graphic language. What's he saying? They're going to happen to them. They're going to, what is it? Roar?
Drink
and roar as with wine. Now I don't mean to say they're going to get stoned, literally, going out to battle, right? All the sling stones are coming at them. They're not going to get drunk, right? It's like being drunk. Anybody who's been drunk, you know, how does a drunk behave? Hey, happy as the day is long, eh? They're rejoicing, they're shouting away and getting carried away, right?
Don't like it,
Until the next hour, lad. For me, he says, they're going to be so elated at the victory I give them, it'd be like they've had too much to drink. That's exactly what happened on the day of Pentecost, isn't it? When the Spirit came down on the disciples, at 9 o'clock in the morning, before the pubs are open, yeah? They're just so full of the Spirit, they're bouncing out, they're jumping out the windows virtually, they burst out onto the street, and all the crowd come out and say, what's going on here? Hey? And some of them said, these men are drunk. And Peter stands up and says, sorry boys, it's only 9 o'clock in the morning. Right? We're not drunk. Yeah? But we're full of the Spirit. Yes, it was what Joel prophesied, yeah. So, you know, when the Spirit gets hold of you, you might get excited.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. Just a warning there, you might get excited. Be good to see sometimes, wouldn't it? Yeah? Burst out of our skins. Right, okay, so, they're getting excited here. Yeah? And then the other bit, they will be full like a bowl used for sprinkling the corners of the altar. Now, I don't guess you understand what that's about, is it? What was the bowl for? It was for collecting the blood of the sacrificed animal. Right? Bit grim, isn't it? I wouldn't have liked to have been a priest in Israel. When they sacrificed an animal, they cut its throat and they collected the blood and they sprinkled the blood on the side of the altar. Yes, the blood was to make atonement for the sins of the people. Obviously it was figurative because animals can't save you. But it was meant to be a picture of what Jesus was going to do. Yeah? But he says, they are going to have a sacrifice. My people are going to have a sacrifice. The enemy is going down. Right, so he's using a pretty graphic image, but that's the idea. They're going to sprinkle it on the altar. The blood of the people is going to be a sacrifice that God's preparing. Yeah? Right. Then, verse 16. The Lord their God will save them on that day as the flock of his people. Is that good?
Yeah, that's his flock.
The Lord their God will save them on that day. He's going to give them a victory. Right? As the flock of his people. Interesting how he uses all these contrasts. One minute they're a bow and arrow, the next minute they're a sword, and now they're a bunch of sheep. Right? Have you ever seen sheep fighting? Well, these sheep can, apparently, can, because the Lord drew them. And he's going to. And when he uses the word flock, what's it mean? It's the idea of God protecting and caring. That's the imagery that he's got there. And then he says, how about this? They will sparkle in his land like jewels in a crown.
Wow.
Yeah? Wow. You've got a sparkle, you've got some bling going? You're going to sparkle. Why?
Because
God's bestowed his beauty on you, his grace and his love and his forgiveness. He's making you something special. And notice the contrast. God's people are going to be precious stones, jewels. What are the enemy going to be? Sling stones. Stuff of the earth, you know. That's all pebbles, right, yeah? Right, contrast. So, and there's a lovely verse in Malachi. He says, God took a notice of those that concerned themselves about God, and they worshipped, and they prayed, and they read his word. And he says, God took notice of them. He says, they will be mine when I come to make up my precious jewels. Yeah, make my crown up. Have you? Yeah? You come across that one, yeah. So, you're going to be one of the shiny stars, eh?
Diamond.
The diamonds, right. Oh well, there you are. Quite interesting imagery, isn't it? Yes. And then verse 17, how attractive and beautiful they will be. Well, there is some dispute whether it's they or whether the person is actually addressing God, how attractive and beautiful he is. Right? It's because they got, it could be this, and I'm inclined to agree with it, but basically it's simply this, that these people, God's talking about the victory he gives them, the tremendous things that are going to happen, and they get so excited they start saying, oh, praise the Lord, wonderful, yeah, isn't he great? Yeah? Well, you can do that, can't you? Right. And that's maybe what they're doing here, right? Paul does that in Romans, by the way. Did you know that? Yeah? In Romans. He says, oh, the depths, the riches, and the wisdom, and the glory of God. That, oh, and then he's writing about what's going on, and then he just breaks off into a chunk of praise. Oh, the debts and the riches and the wisdom. I'll just ask you this question, right? In the bank balance, where do the zeros count?
In the
back, yes. In worship, where do the zeros, the O's count? That's a promise. All the debts. Have you got a zero in your account with the Lord? That's what I'm asking you. Right? Okay. Right, so, he says, they'll be beautiful. Oh, God is beautiful. Those are true, of course. Grain will make the young men thrive, and new wine the young women. Well, what's going on there? Grain will make the young men thrive.
Grain is,
it's food, isn't it? Yeah, that's where it starts, yeah, it's food, yeah? Grain will make the young men thrive, right? What's the idea? What are you talking about? God's given them a victory, and as a result of that victory, what are they going to enjoy?
Life.
Prosperity and peace and blessing, right? Grain grows when there's peace, right? And the grain's going to feed who? The young men. And the young men haven't been killed, right? And the young men are growing and going and doing, right? And the young girls, what are they doing? Well, he says they will, they'll be like new wine, the young women. They will be like that, new wine, the young women. Nice. What's new wine like?
Fresh,
bubbly, nice. Yeah, you're a bit of bubbly. No good. Very good. Excellent. Right. So it's God's blessing he's talking about, right? So on we go. Right. Right. Carry on. Chapter 10. Although it's all part of the same story. Ask the Lord for rain in the springtime. Right? It's the Lord who makes the storm clouds. Right? Ask the Lord for rain in the springtime. What he's saying is, God's promised this. God's promised to bless you. What have you got to do? Ask! Exactly, ask! And it shall be, we sung it. Ask and it shall be. Good, I've got pieces together here. Ask and it shall be given. He's saying, if God put these blessings here, they're waiting for you on the shelf with your name on it. You've got to ask. Right? So he said, come and ask, seek this blessing. And he said, ask the Lord for rain in the springtime. What's the rain in the springtime?
As it comes.
It's later on, actually. It's to say, it's the latter rain. I think, I could be wrong, there are the former rains in the autumn to start them the growing season. And then later on, the spring rains and the latter rains, which then fill up the grain to make it ready for harvest. Right? So, ask for the rain to get you plump. Right? So you get your barley growing and your wheat growing and get the stuff growing great, eh? Alright? I don't mean visually, of course, but you know what I mean. Yes, right. Okay. Ask for the Lord for rain in the springtime. It's He who makes the storm clouds. Right now, then. What do storm clouds mean? Usually. Threatening.
Yeah.
Sounds a bit threatening, but that's not what it means here, of course. The context makes it quite obvious that the storm clouds are threatening. What are the storm clouds? Are a promise of an abundance of rain. Right, that's the picture, isn't it? Yeah? God is going to... You ask Him for it. Yeah? Right? That's what Elijah did, wasn't it? He prayed after the end of that 3.5 years of drought. He went up on Mount Carmel and started praying. And he kept praying 7 times. And he asked his servant, what can you see? He says, at the end of it all, well, first, can't see anything, boss. Right? And then at the end of it, he said, I see a cloud as small as the hand of a man's fist. Yeah? And Elijah says, we'd better get shifting because the rain's coming. And when he started travelling, it absolutely drenched the place. Yeah? So that's it. Ask the Lord for the rains, and He will bring it. He gives showers of rain to men and plants of the field to everyone. Isn't that good? Yeah? The Lord's providing. Praise His name. Yes. Then, verse 2 is there. He's talking about the past, but it's the idea of continuing in the present. The idols speak deceit. Diviners see visions that lie. They tell dreams that are false. They give comfort in vain. And therefore the people wander like sheep, oppressed for lack of a shepherd. Right? So, what he's saying is that's what happened in the past. You know, Jeremiah was talking about the false shepherds and all of that. He says they give them their dreams and they carry their visions and it's a whole load of baloney. They're saying it's all going to be nice and hunky-dory. Yeah, just carry on. And Jeremiah's saying it's not going to be nice and hunky-dory if you carry on. If you change your ways, it's going to be okay. But if you don't, big time trouble. So he says the diviners, they're telling you lies. Right? And he got the people into trouble. They didn't want to hear Jeremiah. They preferred to hear the nice stuff. Right? Only trouble was the nice stuff was getting them deeper into trouble. And he's saying that's what happened there. And the danger for the Israelites in Zechariah's time is There will be false prophets again. There are false prophets always around. The devil will see to it. Isn't that what Peter warns us?
Yeah.
You've heard about it in the last days. Paul says the same. There will be false teachers. Don't buy their junk. Right? Because they'll trip you up if you're not careful. Right? So he says, and the danger is, as a result, the people wander like sheep oppressed for lack of a shepherd. They've just got scattered as a result of their sins. Right? So the warning is, yeah, I'll bless you, but that doesn't allow for complacency. Stick at it with me. Right? My anger burns against the shepherd, and I will punish the leaders, for the Lord will care for his flock, the house of Judah, and make them like proud horse in battle. Right? So, who are the shepherds? Who are the shepherds that God's angry with? False prophets, but shepherds are more than the teachers, I think. What's a shepherd? He's a leader. He's the leaders. The king and his government, right? God was upset by the government of Israel, right? And I think probably upset by a few more governments in our world as well, right? And he says there, I'm angry with these shepherds, I will punish the leaders, right? Just to say there, that's an illustration of how the Bible often speaks. It uses what terms of parallel. Have you come across that parallelism? It says it one way, and then it says it another way. The same thing. So that verse says, my anger burns against the shepherds. Right? That's one way of saying it. And then, I will punish the leaders. Same message. They've got trouble coming to the leaders. Right?
Okay.
For the Lord Almighty will care for his flock. Isn't that beautiful? Right, God's going to look after you, which is nice. The house of Judah, that's his flock. When he says the house of Judah there, that doesn't mean, I don't think, just Judah. He meant the people of the Jews. Right? They gathered together, and Judah was the sort of main leader at that time. Yeah? I'll make them like a proud horse in battle. We change the picture again. They're not a bow and arrow now, nor a sword. They're a horse. Right? A battle horse. Right? A proud horse. And the horse was decorated with all these sort of flashy things, you know. That's what the proud horse means, yeah. And Judah, from Judah will come the cornerstone. Right? That's the foundation bit, isn't it? See, God's going to build using his people, right? He says, from him, the tent peg. Right? That's for building with, isn't it? The tent peg's to lock the thing into place. Mm. What about, from him, the battle bow? Right? So God's going to produce the fighters. And from him, every ruler. Right, the rulers are going to come after Judah as well. So, things are looking good, is that right? Right? Together, they will be like mighty men, trampling muddy streets in the battle. Because the Lord is with them, they will fight and overthrow the horsemen. Right, same idea. In the battles that God's people face, if they trust in God, God will give you a victory. Just as well then? Right. Then he says this. This is quite remarkable, this little section now. I will strengthen the house of Judah and save the house of Joseph. Right? Just ask you a question then. Who's the house of Joseph? No? No, good try, though. No? Yes? It's the northern kingdom. The northern kingdom consisted of Ephraim, the half tribe of Manasseh, and all the other 10 tribes. Right? Yes? But the head tribe was Ephraim. And who was Ephraim's son? Was Joseph. Yeah? Right? So sometimes the northern kingdom is called Joseph as well, right? Okay, that's where he's getting at. Yeah? So the whole group of the Jewish people, he says he's going to use them and bless them, right? And he will restore them because I have compassion on them. It will be as though I had not rejected them. Right? Isn't that amazing? God's made a promise. And he's Zechariah and his people were part of the answer to that. They were exiles who'd come back from Babylon. Right? And so God had restored them. But they were just a few. And in the times, later on in the centuries, they were just a few that came back. There's thousands, but not the whole group of the people that were scattered, right? And then he talks about this coming along then. Now, just let me read this section for you. I will restore them and because I have compassion on them. They will be as though I have not rejected them, for I am the Lord their God, and will answer them. The Ephraimites will become like mighty men, and their hearts will be glad as with wine. Their children will see it and be joyful. Their hearts will rejoice in the Lord. I will signal for them, and gather them in. Surely I will redeem them, and they will be as numerous as before. And though I scatter them among the peoples, yet in distant lands they will remember me. They and their children will survive, and they will return. I will bring them back from Egypt and gather them from Assyria. I'll bring them to Gilead and Lebanon. There will not be a rough route. There will not be room enough for them. And though they pass through the sea of trouble, the surging sea will be subdued, and in all the depths of the Nile will dry up. Assyria's pride will be brought down, and Egypt's scepter will pass away. And I will strengthen them in the Lord, and in His name they will walk, declares the Lord. Eh? That's the promise of a regathering, worldwide regathering. We're seeing it in our days, aren't we? And it's rather interesting. As I said, we've been looking at the commentary and trying to digest a bit of it by Hengstenberg, William Hengstenberg. He died before I was born. You can imagine, he lived in the 1800s, yes? Right? But he died before 1949. And what's significant about 1948-49 was the birth of Israel. Right? So he talks about the gathering, talking about the time of the Maccabees. We'll come to that in a moment. But this is worldwide. This isn't just from the Middle East and around that area. This is worldwide gathering. And of course, it's talking about the Jews. He says, God's going to signal for them. He's going to whistle. Did you know God whistled? Yes? Oh, yes.
He's whistling.
He's calling, yes, that's right. God can whistle. Great, eh? Right. And he's calling them back, right? And they'll come back, and he says, their children will survive. There's a promise, there's a future. When you've got the kids, there's a future, isn't there? That's the idea. And though they pass, they will pass through the sea of trouble, right? And the surging sea will be subdued. Well, they went through a sea of trouble, all right? But he says, he's going to strengthen them and bless them. And they will walk in his name, they will walk. Right? Interesting, I think that tells us. They're coming back in unbelief, but they will come to believe in it. They will walk in his name. To walk in his name means to be a believer. You're walking in his name, you're a follower of Jesus. Right? That's what it's about, isn't it? So there's the promise. Right? And he said he's going to do that. Isn't that wonderful?
Yeah.
Right. So I'll have to stop there. I'm going to show you how that great promise was first fulfilled about the Greece, you know, your fight against Greece. So we're going to have to use a little PowerPoint for this, if you can. See if you can get it to work. Right, yes. Put slideshow. Can you see slideshow on the top line there? Yeah, run that. Yeah. View the show, yes. Right, okay. Here we are. Have you heard of Hanukkah?
Yeah.
Yeah.
We celebrated at Bible College.
Did you? Okay, right. It's another party, isn't it? That's what it is.
Yeah,
yes.
Okay. Another feast.
It's another feast. And by the time we've got to the end, you'll realise why it's another feast. This, remember, he's going to turn Judah into a bow and Ephraim as his arrows to fight the Greeks? Well, it looked completely impossible, but let's see what happens. Right, next then, please. Try that one, yes, see if it works. I think you can just let click it, actually. Go on, yeah, next, yeah, that's fine, yeah. Right, in 300 BC, right, in 300 BC, when Greek soldiers came to the Middle East, they brought with them many aspects of their culture, which was pagan, right? Top pagan, idolatry, immorality, you name it, they did it. Right. If you want perversions, study the Greeks. I'm not suggesting you do, but there you are. Right, they've got all sorts of stuff going. Next then, please. Including, these are all the things. Art. Right, they did some tremendous art, didn't they? Some fantastic artwork. They were brilliant sculptors, yeah? Philosophy. Thinking. That messed people up quite a lot, the philosophy. Architecture, pretty good on buildings. And sports. They introduced the Olympics, you know. Right, so they're pretty good at that. Right, so, some good stuff. But, next please, a new culture was formed which is called Hellenism. Hellenism is the name of Greece, that's the word, yeah? So Hellenism was the culture, right? It's Western culture today, by the way. It's the way the modern world thinks. It's humanism, really. Right, next then please. Right. One of the central themes of Greek culture was that of humanism. Humanism is the belief that humans are the centre of everything. Right. It says, this is a little cartoon. Then I came to the conclusion that the greatest cause for humanity was me. Right. Yeah, we're the centre. Right? That's really what Satan promised Adam and Eve. Yeah. You'll be like God. You'll be there. You'll be top dog. Yeah? Right, and so that's what the Greeks got that idea as well, of course. Right. Next one, please, yes. Right. This is very different to Judaism, which looks at God at the centre of everything, right? God is the source of our life. He's the one that maintains our lives. Right, so that's a complete way of, different way of thinking to the Greek way. Right? And brothers and sisters, it's still around. If you think like a Jew, God's in the middle. If you think like a Greek, well, you're in the middle. You're the big one, right? That's our culture today. It's Greek. The way we think, right? Like Tony Blair and his mate says, we don't do God here. Well, God does them, definitely, whether they do him or not. Next one, please. Right. The Greeks believed so strongly that their culture was superior to all the others that they wanted to impose their lifestyles upon everyone. That's the Greek way of doing it, yeah? They will not tolerate disagreements. Right? It's our culture today. You disagree with them, that's culture. And so they thought, we're the best, we're superior, so everybody else should be like us. A great idea, isn't it? Oh well. Next then, please. Right. Many Jews became very attracted to the Greek culture. They formed the Jewish-Greek Council. Right. Some of them, they wanted to assimilate, that's the word that's used today. Right? To blend in with the background, you might, yeah? You heard about the policeman that was into a major crash, and there were people, it was a first aid test, you know, they were saying, what would you do if you're in this tremendous crash, and there's three people lying, one screaming for all they're worth there, there's three people in the car, absolutely silent, and it's about to catch fire, right? There's a gas main just gone up, and it's blowing away there, right? What would you do? And the policeman said, I'd take off my uniform and blend in with the crowd. Right, that's what they were doing. Blending in with the crowd. Don't want to stand out. Right, next one, please. Yeah. The group was small but very vocal and very powerful. Isn't that like today?
Yeah.
We have pressure groups that are pushing Greek culture, right, in our society. There are many that you believe they were, the way they talk. Right, so... And they became just as Greek as the Greeks. And they began to send their kids to the gymnasium. That's the school. The gymnasium was a school, by the way, right? Okay. They even went through painful surgeries so they wouldn't stand out as being Jewish.
That's
how you found it. No, that's one of these Greek structures, yeah?
No.
Right, no. It's one of these little school places where they run around and study. Yeah, they're very learned lot, yes. Okay, right, next slide, please. Right. In many ways, the main conflict was between the mainstream Jews and these Hellenized Jews, right? So, it was clash of cultures. Still happens, yeah? Clash of cultures. If you are a Bible-believing Christian today, you are having a culture clash in our society. Believe me. Yeah? Right, so that was then. Next then, please. At first, there was harmony between the Jews and the Greeks. Well, we got on all right. We'll let them live and they'll let us live. Will they? They won't let us live, no. But we like to think so. Right, next one, please. Right. But then the Greeks started looking at the bizarre practices of the Jews and started thinking of the Jews as a challenge to their world supremacy. Yeah? Well, they look at the way the believers are different to them.
Yeah.
And they feel threatened. Always the way it works. I mean... Happened in Egypt with Pharaoh. Pharaoh saw the Israelites and he felt threatened. There were no threats, but he felt threatened, right? And it's the same in our culture. It happened in the days of communism, right? Why did they persecute the Christians? Remember that dear brother in Romania? What was his pastor? Somebody?
Wurmbrand.
Wurmbrand, yes. Yeah, Pastor Wurmbrand. He went to the authorities and said, why are you persecuting Christians? They're your best citizens. They don't get drunk every night of the week. They work like their socks off. They pay their taxes. And here you are, persecuting them and sending them to prison. Why? Why do they persecute them? Because we don't serve their gods. And we're the threat. We don't jump to their tune. So we're the threat. We're not a threat, really, but that's how they perceive it. And that's exactly what the Greeks thought. They saw these Jews living their ways, certainly seeking to please God, and not bowing down to their culture and their gods, and they thought, oh, we can't have this. We've got to get rid of them, right? So next one, please. Right. And more Greeks became hostile to the Jews. Well, this is modern version, but still there. We call them Greeks, but it's this humanistic culture. Right. So they start splattering names and abusive things around, yeah? Next one, please. The Greek Empire split into three distinct empires. That's what happened when Alexander the Great died. He it was split into four, but one of them got swallowed up, yes? And there was the Seleucid, the Ptolemaean, and the Macedonian, right? And, right, so you've got these empires. This one, and this one, right? And who's in the middle? It's Israel. So it works, yes? Yeah? That's how God always did it, yeah? Always in the middle. Right, so who are they going to choose? None of them is what they should choose, right? So next then, please, yeah? At first, the Jews were under the rule of the Ptolemaeans, that's with Egypt, yeah? Who were generally liberal and tolerant of other beliefs, right? So the Egyptians had had a long time getting used to other religions and so on, so they were alright, yeah? For a while. But then, oh, that's too fast, back one, previous. But then things got much worse when the region was taken over by the Seleucids. That's the Syrians, we call them now, I suppose, yeah? Whose king was named Antiochus. Yeah, they had various kings called Antiochus. This is one. And Antiochus Epiphanes was the real nasty piece of work. Antiochus Epiphanes means Antiochus the illustrious one, you know, flash. Right? And the Jews renamed him Antiochus Epiphanes, which means the nutter. Yeah? Right? Because he was. As you'll see. Next then, please. Right? Antiochus came to the conclusion that his weakest link in the defence against the Ptolemies was the Jews. Always blame the Jews. Right? That's the way it worked. So, he doesn't look very happy, does he? Right, next then, please. Yes. He started taking measures to force the Jews to become more like the Greeks. Right? That's the first measure. Make them all like us. If they don't bend, we'll kill them. That's modern one now, isn't it? Right, next then, please. He replaced the high priest, right? Go for the religion. He replaced the high priest with a Jew he controlled, thus completely corrupting the temple service. I've got them as a puppet. The high priest was doing what he was told, right? By them, not by the law. The other is, he banned the use of the Jewish calendar, knowing full well how the focus the Jews were on various Jewish holidays, right? Try and stop the parties and the celebrations. Right? Well, he's going to fail, isn't he, yes? Because all of this, they think they're just fighting Jews, you know, it's just a culture, you know, cultures come, cultures go. Right? Unfortunately, he didn't realise he's fighting God. Yeah. Right, next one, please. Right? He prohibited keeping kosher, that's the way to fix them. Get them to eat meat, pork, that'll fix it out. And he prevented them studying the Bible, the Torah. Right? Now that is really dangerous, yeah? If you stop people getting the truth, then you start getting them believing anything. Just about, right? That's what he tried. Next one, please. The Greeks burnt Torah scrolls. Well, what did Hitler and his gang do? They were burning Bibles by those books, or weren't they? The Jewish material, right? And, how about this? They filled the temple with idols and swine sacrifices. Absolute desecration, that was, wasn't it? Yeah? Right, trying to be as offensive as he possibly could. Right, so, he wasn't very popular with some people, as you can imagine. Next one, please, yeah? He forbade the practice of circumcision. Stop them being Jews altogether. Right, okay. Then, next please. Nevertheless, many Jews passively resisted doing the practices despite the prohibition. Right. They did what a lot of Christians have to do in the world is they kept their heads down, but they carried on as normal. Yeah. Right. And that's the case in some parts of the world, isn't it? Yeah. Some believers, you know, they just have to keep their heads down, but they'll still worship the Lord, they'll still praise and serve the Lord where they can. Right. Next thing, please. Right. Often, paying for their resistance with their lives. Right. When you get found out in those sort of regimes, that's the end of the story as far as you're concerned. Yeah? Right. But the Lord has them on his list. So they're not lost. That's good news, isn't it? That seems sad. Next thing, please. Right. Until one day. Ta-da! Right. Yes. Right. The Greeks marched into the Jewish town of Modi'in. Right, well, that's probably Greeks, of course. It was the First World War picture. They marched into the town of Modi'in. Right, next slide, please. Right? And they demanded a volunteer to sacrifice a pig to a Greek idol. Yeah? I mean, this is what the persecutors do all the time. They try to make the believer deny his faith. I mean, that's what they're doing there. Yeah? Right? And it's happened all the way from the beginning. Yeah? You've heard about John the Apostle, the man who wrote the Revelation. Right? He was arrested as a very old man by the Romans, and he was brought before them in the big Colosseum, and all the crowd baying for their blood, of course, and the soldier centurion guy says to him, "Come on, all you've got to do to be free is to deny Jesus, right? Just deny your God, yeah? Right? All you've got to do," and what he was told to say was, "Away with the atheists," because Christians were called atheists. Did you know that?
Yeah.
Because they didn't believe in the gods. Yeah? There's only one God. So we didn't believe in all the gods. Right? So all he had to say was, "Away with the atheists." And so John, as an old man, he says, and he looks at the crowd, "Away with the atheists." Yeah? And the soldier knew what he meant. He didn't mean away with God, he said away with that lot. Yeah. Right? And the chap says, "That's not what I meant. You know that, yes. You've got to deny Jesus." And he said this. He didn't read his words. They're published, yeah. He says, "Jesus has been faithful to me these 70 years or so. I don't know what the exact number was. Jesus has been faithful to me. He's never failed me. He's never let me down. I'm not going to deny him now." Right? And they executed it. Right? He paid for it with his life. And that's what... that's what he wanted to do. Deny your faith. It'd be so easy. I could give you countless times of people who laid down their lives. In China, in the Boxer Rebellion, when the communists and the others decided to attack all the missionaries and the Christians, right, there was one instance where the mother of several children was told, and the father was there, Christian family, and the authority says, "If you deny your faith, man, we'll let you all your family go. But if you don't, we're going to kill your wife and your children, and you as well." Right. And his children said to him, "Dad, do not deny Jesus. We'll be seeing him this evening." Yeah. That's incredible courage, isn't it? Yeah? 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 But that's what Christians are called on to do at times. You know? We may be called on to do that somewhere in our country. You know, it's getting more dangerous for Christians. They will want you to deny you're a follower and a faithful follower of Jesus. And that's what happened that day. Right? They turned up and says, "Right, we're going to show you Jews, you're going to be a denier." Right, next one please. Yeah. When someone volunteered, there's always some jerk turns out to do the dirty work. Yeah. When someone volunteered, Matityahu, right, rose up. That's a great name, yeah? I've got the Scotsman there. Yeah, right. He rose up, killed the volunteer and the Greek general, and called his people to rebel in the name of the Lord. "We've had enough. We're not putting up with this anymore." So he killed the bloke and the guy who was ordering him to do it. Right. So they're in trouble now, aren't they? Next thing, please. Matityahu, along with his five sons. Right. You pronounce these names, can you? Yochanan, Shimon, Yehuda HaMaccabee, Eleazar and Jonathan. That's Jonathan at the bottom, if you didn't know. That's the guy who became the leader, really. It's Judas. Yehuda is Judas. Judas Maccabeus. Right, that's how we know him, yeah? Right, so he's five lads. Next, please. Right. They went to the hills to fight with a guerrilla warfare against the Greeks. Right. Vastly outnumbered, but they started the guerrilla warfare against the Greeks. Right. There's some IDF soldiers there, I think that's what they are. Right, next one please. Right. The Greek army was 40,000 strong. No one knows exactly how big the Jewish army got, but the biggest estimates are 12,000.
Oh,
right. Impossible odds, aren't it?
Yeah.
Right. Well, next one please. Right. Not to mention that the Greeks were trained soldiers with proper fighting equipment. All the Israelites had was sticks and stones, basically. Yeah? Right, okay. Next one, please. And they also had elephants. That's the Greeks, yeah? They got all the weaponry, all the power, but they hadn't read Zephaniah. See? Oh, no, Zephaniah, Zechariah, sorry. They hadn't read Zechariah, otherwise they wouldn't have bothered coming. Right, but never mind, they didn't know that. Next one, please. Right? The war would last a total of 25 years with many casualties on both sides. So it was brutal. Yes, it was brutal. But, next please, 3 years into the war, the Jews successfully conquered Jerusalem. Right, that was their headquarters, the title place here. Right, so, that insignificant group defeated a massive army to get to Jerusalem. There's still more to be fighting to be done, but they got Jerusalem, right? Then, next please. They found the temple defiled with idols and swine. Pig blood and everything else had been offered. They messed up the place, of course. Wrecked it. That was a really terrible thing. So, what did they do? Next, please. Right. They searched, this is 164 BC, we've got to now, yeah? Yeah. They searched and found only one flask of pure olive oil to light the menorah in the temple. So they cleaned the place out. Right. They got rid of all the rubbish, they got it cleaned up, and they wanted to get the, you know, the menorah? It's the branch candlestick.
Yeah.
Right, the big candlestick, yeah? And they got just enough oil to light the temple candles, right? Or the lamps, that is, yeah? Next then, please. But, there was a miracle.
Yeah.
It was enough oil to last for one day, and miraculously it lasted for eight, which gave them enough time to produce some more. Right?
Where's this quill?
I'm not sure. Yeah. So there you are. It was a miracle.
Yeah.
God did that with Elijah, remember? Mm-hmm. When they were on starvation everywhere else. And he went to that woman's house, the widow, and she offered to make, well, he asked her to make some bread, and she said, I've only got enough bread, enough flour and oil for today. We're going to eat up, and that's it. Right? He says, well, you make me one first. And he says, the oil will never run out, the flour won't run out until the time for the rains. And sure enough, every day, filled the bottle with it. That's happened since, you know. There are accounts of people in other parts of the world where there's been miracles happening. Corrie ten Boom, have you read the story of the hiding place? Corrie ten Boom, in the Nazi concentration camp, they had in their cell a pregnant woman, right? And they had a bottle of vitamins, right? And they gave her a drop of vitamin every day out of that bottle for months and months. And it didn't dry up. We've got a good God, you know. Right, so that was a miracle. They celebrate that. Next, please. Right, so the Festival of Lights. The temple was rededicated on the 25th of Kislev. That's about Christmas time now. Yeah. Right. That time has been since celebrated for 8 days every year as the Feast of Hanukkah. Right. So when they light the candles, 8 candles in procession, as the temple lights were lit. Yeah. Right, so, another excuse for a party, of course, yeah. But it's a great time to celebrate. Next week, yeah. And this is to celebrate the two miracles of Hanukkah, right? The victory over the Greeks against impossible odds, and the miracle of the oil. Well, it's worth remembering what God's done, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's what they do. Yes, next then, please. Is that it? And again. Go to the next one. Right there. Right, so we have the menorah. Yes, each night of Hanukkah, the menorah is lit. The menorah symbolizes the burning light in the temple, as well as marking the 8 days of the Hanukkah festival. Right. It's good, eh? That's what they do, you know. Still do that. We don't do it, though, do we? Unless you go to Bible college and you do it there, yeah. Right. Okay. But next, please. There are many different spellings of Hanukkah, you notice this. Right. All those are variations. I should have gone through the world. Hanukkah is one of them as well. That's how you pronounce it, isn't it, Gene?
Yeah.
Right, okay, next one, please. Present day Hanukkah. Right. What's this? Ah, yes. They have presents. They have these things. Next one, please. It's turned up. It's high powered, isn't it? I forgot they'd done that, yes. Children play a game with a spinning top called a dreidel. Families eat special oily food to remember the importance of the oil lamp. And presents are also given at this time. Get close to Christmas, doesn't it, really? That's the idea, I suppose. Okay. Next one, please. December the 20th. The dreidel. There we are. The dreidel. It's a four-sided spinning top. This is for the kids to play with. Right? Perhaps you could make one of these one time. Yeah, you youths. Right? Right? A four-sided spinning top, and each side is engraved with a different Hebrew letter. NGHS. Right? In Hebrew, of course. Right? And the letters mean... a great miracle has happened here. Next is a miracle. Gadol is great. Hayah has. and here is Sham. Yeah? So a great miracle has happened here, and they play a game with it. I don't know how what the game's about, but there you are. That's what they do. Next one, please. And then, of course, yes. Jim made some of these for us some time ago, right? Many traditional Hanukkah foods are cooked in oil, in remembrance of the oil that burned in the temple. Latkes or potato pancakes are a favourite food at Hanukkah. And they were rather nice, me too. Yes, okay.
I'll make some
sometime. Make some sometime again. Right, next one, please. Here we are. Then came the festival of dedication at Jerusalem. This is in the New Testament, right? And this is the instance of the Feast of Hanukkah in John's Gospel that Jesus attended. Jesus attended the feast, yeah? It says here, then came the feast of the festival of dedication at Jerusalem. It was winter, and Jesus was in the temple courts walking in Solomon's colonnade. The Jews who were there gathered round him, saying, how long will you keep us in suspense? If you are the Messiah, tell us plainly. Right, and then the next one tells us, when Jesus spoke again to the people, he said, I am the light of the world. Whoever follows me will never walk in darkness, but have the light of life. Right. Jesus is taking the festival, celebrating light, the candle, or the oil to provide the light, the victory that God gave, and Jesus turns up, center stage, and says, me it's talking about. I'm the light that you're looking for. That's astounding. I mean, this is really sort of strong stuff he's giving them. So, our Lord fulfills what he's talking about. So we've got round to Jesus. I think that's the last one, isn't it?